Hello and welcome to this podcast interview on strategic litigation in EU law. My name is Marta Morvillo and I'm here with Marta Pardavi and Gruzsa Matevcic from the Hungarian Helsinki Committee to discuss about strategic litigation in EU law. This podcast takes place in the context of a special issue I'm co-editing with my colleagues Paula Cebulak from the Free University of Amsterdam and Stefan Salomon from the University of Amsterdam. The special issue focuses on strategic litigation as a legal action initiated to achieve broader social, political, and economic goals, and asks, who does strategic litigation with EU law empower? We will discuss this with Marta Pardavi, who is co-chair of the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, and with Gruzsa Matevcic, who is senior legal officer at the Hungarian Helsinki Committee. Let us start with your organization. This is a Budapest-based human rights organization founded in 1989. It provides help to refugees, detainees, and victims of state violence through litigation and advocacy. So, as an organization, you have been involved in strategic litigation for quite some time. How did strategic litigation become one of the priorities of the Hungarian Helsinki Committee?
So hello, and thank you very much for inviting us on this podcast. The Hungarian Helsinki Committee is one could say, a classic human rights organization in the sense that we use a number of methods and tools to try to assist both our clients, but also to achieve improvements in legal standards and practices in Hungary and also in Europe. And these methods, of course, encompass research and monitoring, policy analysis, legislative advocacy, communication, and litigation. And so we've always seen legal assistance and litigation as part of a broader set of tools that human rights organizations can deploy. And for a very long time, as we were able to see by and large, of course, improvements in the Hungarian human rights framework, partly due to the European accession process, we were considering litigation as part of a regular toolbox to help our clients. But this changed, I think, quite fundamentally in the past 20 years, and particularly since 2010. And why is that change? That change has come about because we've had to see that it's not only the human rights issues and the people whose human rights are being breached in Hungary are not only those who fall, so to say, through the cracks of an otherwise well-working system, but rather the system itself is breaking down, that we have systemic breakdowns of human rights protection, systemic rule of law breakdowns. And so in order to find answers and results, we have had to consider our work in a more strategic manner. And so strategic litigation became a more pronounced focus of our activities. And we do this not only from the point of view of helping clients, but also as litigation, we think, contributes to strengthening the rule of law and fundamental rights protection in a systemic way. And the litigation can actually not only help the individuals, but reinforce a system, a framework to protect human rights and the rule of law.
Thank you very much. I would actually ask you a follow-up question on this. And this concerns the relationship between strategic litigation and legal aid. And how do you strike a balance between these two? In the sense that, on the one hand, strategic litigation has this focus on key cases that aim at making sort of a broader change, while legal aid, of course, aims at reaching as many people as possible, essentially. How do you balance, as an organization, these two strategies?
Yeah, this is an ever-present question and dilemma. Normally, For a very long time, the Helsinki Committee has provided legal aid in the sense of helping anybody who has a problem where we saw the organization's mandate being relevant. So this would mean both refugees coming to Hungary, but also Hungarian citizens who, for example, had been ill-treated either in detention or during a police action. These were classic cases where we made every effort to help everybody. At the same time, we also, on a more systemic level, looked at how the legal aid system in Hungary is working and had made a lot of policy recommendations and had a lot of projects testing out various ways that the legal aid system in Hungary could be improved. And then this broke down. So we had to really reconsider both the impact we're having and the resources that we're able to mobilize for this. And I think Grusha can talk about how this played out, particularly with our refugee program, which since the mid-90s has always provided legal aid to asylum seekers in Hungary.
Yes. Hello also from my side. Yes, from the refugee program perspective, I still remember we had our first ECHR case in 2010. We were addressing the problem of illegal detention, unlawful detention, but these were sporadic cases, few of them followed, but that was, you know, not like a mass litigation. There was also some preliminary references referred. The first one happened in 2009. But also just few of such cases. And then in 2015, everything went really bad. The government started to dismantle relatively well-functioning asylum system from all the aspects, like the access was like almost non-existing anymore. The protection itself, the reception conditions, the integration. So all the levels of asylum system were attacked. And this is when our litigation, but also strategic litigation, became more intense. And it resulted in, so far we have like more than 100 cases in front of ECHR. And I mean, we had more than 10, the dozens, dozen, 12, sorry, more than 12 CGU preliminary references. The problem was that the legislation introduced was not compliant with the EU law. That was not done in denial. The government was openly admitting that it's not compliant with the EU law, but they were justifying it with the introduction of the state of mass migration, of the crisis of due to mass migration, and they felt that they are legitimately going around the EU law by introducing provisions that they seemed fit. And that's when nothing else actually worked. There was no more dialogue with the government. Before, when I joined the Helsinki Committee in 2009, my colleagues were regularly meeting with the asylum department. They had dialogues that maybe were not always successful, but you know, there were meetings, there was discussion. From 2015 on, this practically stopped. We could not meet anyone anymore. There was no real possibility for national advocacy. So then really litigation was the only tool left, as Marta already mentioned. When it comes to the question of the legal aid, I think we believe that it cannot exist without, strategic litigation cannot exist without free legal aid, because it's not just that you would go to the field, pick one case and, oh great, now I'm bringing this case to the court and it's gonna be strategic. In order to actually have a case, you need to go through several dozens, tens, hundreds of legal aid cases, and then maybe one results, or few, if you're lucky, result in a strategic case. So you really, legal aid is really crucial, and it's really a problem when it's not, you know, given by the state, when the state does not ensure it. So you need to find different funding opportunities to be able to provide free legal aid to those in need.
Thank you. I would maybe now take a step back and ask you a more general question on strategic litigation as a practice. So in your view, which are the conditions and that should be fulfilled in order to bring a successful case of strategic litigation? And here I'm thinking of political conditions, like indeed having a government that is committed to liberal democracy or the availability of effective participatory avenues, but also legal conditions like judicial independence or funding or societal support. So which do you see as the, let's say, necessary conditions in order to bring a strategic case?
So all the conditions that you listed, both the political, the socioeconomic, going to the more practical in terms of organizations, expertise and resources and time, I think are all relevant. First of all, when we think about this, perhaps one of the first things that comes to us is the question of time and patience, because strategic litigation really requires a lot of this. And many times our clients, this is, I think, the experience we have both from all the areas of the Hungarian Helsinki Committee's legal work, the clients themselves are quite impatient, understandably so. So the time factor, the patience factor is really important. The other thing is, of course, the resources. So we provide legal assistance, but we cannot provide other types of assistance that many times our clients would need. And therefore, the resources, meaning also networks and partnerships with others, will be very, very important. A lawyer will have, of course, limitations always. And many of our clients are in extremely difficult circumstances. They have been detained unlawfully. They have been detained endlessly without knowing when they will be able to be released. Sometimes they've had food denied over the years. When it comes to asylum seekers held at the Hungarian border, these were typical scenarios. So it is actually extremely challenging for somebody to be sitting and waiting for a court judgment. But the other aspect is, I think, the expertise. So over time, our legal team in the Helsinki Committee has gained quite a lot of expertise with the European Court of Human Rights. The first cases that they started taking related to investigating police ill-treatment cases in Hungary. So these were Article 3 cases, many of them. And this experience and expertise could be then shared or transposed into asylum cases. But there are many other cases where we have not had this expertise. And so or just the experience has to be built up. And so we rely, I think, quite a lot on training opportunities and collaborative opportunities with other legal professionals. And in this case, I think NGO networks and networks where NGOs collaborate with legal practitioners are extremely useful. So beyond the time and the patience, I think the resources are really important so that people could actually connect with other legal practitioners across borders who work in the same legal space and share experiences. And this requires these legal networks to function. One of them is in asylum, the Elena network, which we found very useful. But there are many others. Perhaps those on the rule of law aspect are just evolving.
Yes, I would only add to this that, the fact that you provide legal aid, right, in at the very beginning, this kind of enables you also to detect that there might be systemic issues. So you need first, in order to start with strategic litigation, you need to have a systemic issue. This often, if you just have sporadic few cases, you don't see the pattern. But let me mention an example. For few years ago, we noticed through our clients that there is an increase in decisions issued based in cases where there was a risk to national security. So Clients were considered a risk to national security, and they were either denied refugees international protection status, or the status was withdrawn, or they were denied the residence permits. And, you know, if this would be just few, one client here and there, we wouldn't think that there is an issue. But we noticed that this increased, and we noticed that it was in situations where people really did not know why are they considered a risk. And that's where we, you know, saw that there is a big problem in Hungarian system, because you get no access to any information whatsoever. Why are you considered a risk? And that's how our whole litigation started in this field. And we were lately successful at the Luxembourg court, because we got two positive judgments in this field, obliging now the authorities to disclose at least the essence of the grounds why somebody is considered at risk. So you need to be aware of the problem. You need to see there is a systemic problem. Second, what Marta already mentioned, yes, you need resources also because, yes, it takes so long time. And during this time, you need to stay in touch with clients. And if clients are foreigners and they not necessarily stay in Hungary and they go abroad and they, you know, maybe in illegal way or it doesn't matter what kind of way, but it's really hard to stay in touch. And for this, you need really a lot of time, a lot of people to follow up with all those clients. If you are involved in massive litigation, as we were, because so many people suffered from human rights violations, like hundreds were detained in the transit zones, we had to help them. So that's how we brought so many cases to European Court of Human Rights. Then we also had to stay in touch with so many people. So it's not just the legal work, it's everything around as well that counts, and it's really important. And for all this, of course, you need funding. And we see that funding is not that openly available when it comes to litigation, because usually, as I said before, this is in normal states covered by free legal aid, but in countries as Hungary, this is not the case. And then it's really important to find donors who would support litigation, but unfortunately there's not so many of donors that would be willing to just fund this part of our work.
Yes, it is indeed, I guess, also from the donor's perspective, litigation is probably less appealing than a campaign or kind of more advocacy activities. I think that's also maybe litigation, unfortunately, is not yet perceived as a very attractive avenue in this sense, which, I mean, knowing like then the impact that it can have is actually a pity. But yeah. So you mentioned the importance of the European Court of Human Rights, both numerically, kind of in terms of how many cases you brought to the European Courts of Human Rights, but also as sort of the first supranational court, international court, to which you directed strategic litigation. And then, so my next question would actually be on at which point did European Union law come in? And what is the relationship between litigation in front of the European Court of Human Rights and litigation that you carry out, that you present in front of the Court of Justice of the European Union?
Yes. So, of course, we always litigate based on the EU law. I mean, if there is any connection with the EU law. As a lawyer, I find the EU law as an extremely useful tool because it supports my arguments. It's not just the national law that we would refer to. You have a secondary EU law, you have the charter that you can refer to, you have developing CGU jurisprudence that supports your arguments. So, of course, we go that way already at the national courts. However, as you know, you cannot just simply turn to the CGU. It has to be the judge. So you need to convince the judge to refer a preliminary reference. And in Hungary, this turned out to be quite difficult. When we had issues like, you know, de facto detention in the transit zones, it took years to convince the court to finally turn the case to turn in the preliminary reference, even though for all of us, it was quite clear that, you know, this is a problem under the EU law, under the reception and return directive, and still no judge was willing to go to CGU because the issue was so political. The same was with, you know, some other, like the classified data, access to classified data cases. There was also quite a struggle to find a judge who would turn to the CGU, while ECHR, you know, you can turn whenever, like when you have a case ready, when you exhaust domestic remedies, then this would be the next step if you could not win the case at the national court. Why EU law is so important is also because of the direct applicability. So what we always argue is that, of course, that first we invite the judge to interpret the domestic legislation in line with the EU law. Why? Because this is, it saves time, right? We don't immediately suggest a preliminary reference because it would mean the case is suspended for 1 or 2 years before the Luxembourg court would decide. We invite the judge to interpret the current legislation based on EU law. The second claim is that we invite the judge that in case there is a national legislation that is really per se compliant with the EU law, to set it aside and to apply the EU law directly. Now you can imagine that this doesn't often happen. So then as a third solution, we propose a preliminary reference referral. And this is usually how we build our cases. And that's how we manage to achieve some really important judgment also at the Luxembourg court.
I just wanted to add to this, in order for EU law to come alive, you need judges at the national courts to think that they also have a role as European judges. And this has become quite challenging in the Hungarian political context, where a lot of human rights issues, such as those related to asylum and migration, but also related to the rule of law, have become very politicized. And judges have, I think, over the years, been made to understand that this kind of politicized cases, yeah, judges have been made to understand that taking on politicized cases carries some sort of risk, a risk to their career, a risk to their promotional prospect, a risk to sort of say getting the corner office or being moved out of a judicial career position. And so you really need judges to be sometimes more courageous than a traditional judge would see their profession. This has been very, very trying and has tested, I think, judges' resilience quite a lot. So when we talk about the independence of judges, we also have to be not only thinking about it in an institutional sense, but also as whether judges individually, in their individual capacity, will be bold enough to apply European Union law or to ask the Court of Justice for an interpretation. And this, in the Hungarian context, has actually meant that certain judges have had been disadvantaged because of using the legal tools at their disposal and raising a question at the Court of Justice. So this kind of these examples set out a chilling effect, and we have to be very mindful of the chilling effect that judges experience. This is another reason why our focus in our advocacy work has shifted so much to ensuring and monitoring and advocating for judicial independence. It's not only for the institutions, but also for the judges themselves, so that they can fulfill their professional duty as European judges.
Thank you. Could you perhaps give us an example of a case in which you actually did manage to get the preliminary reference from the national judge, and what was the, how did you frame kind of the case?
Yes. So I think I will mention the most famous case, I think, that Helsinki Committee in the refugee program has had. which is about the transit zone. So the transit zone were the places of detention. People were held there for the whole time of their asylum procedure. Children with families, unaccompanied minors above the age of 14. So there was this was a really big human rights problem because the government did not consider this to be a place of detention. So no detention order was issued. There was no possibility of judicial review. We tried to argue the domestic courts that this is indeed detention and that it should be people should be released or proper detention orders should be issued, but to no avail. So for many years there was basically like we always suggested a referral to the CGU, but the judges were not willing to do so. Then we brought cases to the European Court of Human Rights, and we won the first such case, Ilyas and Ahmed. The chamber decided this is detention, but then the government appealed. The appeal was accepted, and then the Grand Chamber judgment happened. It's the case Ilyas and Ahmed versus Hungary, quite a famous case, and the Grand Chamber overturned the chamber judgment and said this is not detention. So you can imagine the shock and the lack of, motivation how to continue our work with such a big step in the face. However, at that point, we didn't give up, luckily. And then we had this idea that we should find the right judge to go to Luxembourg, because we still had hopes that based on the EU law, this clearly is detention. And we got this idea to sue the government for the omission. So the omission that they did not, we sued the immigration authority that because they did not issue a detention order and they were in omission because of that. And then the jurisdiction has changed. There was no longer Budapest court's jurisdiction to decide on this, but the other town, Szeged town, which is close to the transit zone. And there were more receptive judges for this issue, maybe also because they were close to the transit zones. They were aware, more like, visually aware of the situation, what is happening there, maybe less under political pressure. So there was few judges that referred this preliminary reference in two cases, FMS and SA is the case, to Luxembourg, and then the judgment followed, and it's clear this is detention, and then it actually got implemented. So the government released all the people that were held there, more than 200 at that time, and they were free, and the transit zones are no longer in use. They still exist, but they are no longer detaining people there. So I think this was a very successful preliminary reference, and it touched upon many other issues, many other problems of the whole asylum and migration system, also regarding return directive, but I won't go into details, but it's a very long judgment with a lot of important decisions inside.
Thank you. And it's actually very interesting to see how it's not just a matter, the strategy is not just about finding the right applicant, but it's also about finding the right judge to some extent when it comes to preliminary references. So that's actually a very, very valid point. Let me go back for a moment to the role of EU law and litigation in front of the CJEU. So I see that there is kind of a double hurdle in a way, in the sense that we have the issue of having the national court involved before the European Court of Justice, and also the issue of having EU law expertise, and also of indeed finding kind of the right judge in this setting. So if these are kind of features that make strategic litigation in front of the Court of Justice, so with EU law, perhaps less attractive or more difficult than litigation in front of the European Court of Human Rights, I was wondering, what are the pluses, what are the advantages of litigating strategically in EU law? so in front of the Court of Justice? Is there any?
I would say because we have, at least in the asylum field, we have set very strong secondary EU law. So these are the directives that are implemented in the national legislation. The law is binding for the member states. So it's much more direct, I would say. So then referring to a convention article and existing jurisprudence under the ECHR. So you have here really an interpretation of the existing provisions which are binding for the member states. So when the judgment comes, it's really like if they implement it properly, I mean, it really leads to a direct change either in legislation or in practice. It should really immediately lead to such changes as it did actually in the case of the transit zones. While the ECHR judgments, I mean, yes, clients get compensation, but we do not often see immediate action, like some general measures being taken from the side of the authorities to change the whole systemic problem. So I would definitely say that having a CGU judgment in your case, it's much more powerful, at least for me. Also, the CGU court itself showed in the past to be more favorable for migration questions than sometimes the CHR court is. There are some problematic judgments that came from ECHR, like Ilyas and Ahmed Grand Chamber judgment, but also some others. So, you know, if the EU law is there, then the CGU is there to interpret it in a way that it's human rights friendly when, you know, there is such a provision in the EU law.
I think difference is in the field of the execution of judgments, particularly in the field of asylum, where the Hungarian government has been taken to court also by the European Commission in infringement cases. We have seen how these rulings have actually triggered legal changes in the Hungarian legal system, and these legal changes are really important. And also what we see is that even these changes are not always implemented in full, or that they don't happen at all. And here the Commission has very strong powers to take back a member state to the court, and then this has happened in several cases when it comes to asylum, with regard to the collective expulsion cases, the pushback cases at the border. The Commission has referred Hungary back to the Court of Justice, and this was the first such case in the history of Hungary's EU membership. But the second similar case has just happened a few days ago, when this form of dismantling an asylum system by completely externalizing asylum claims to non-EU member states was contested and found to be against EU law, and the Hungarian government has not lifted a finger. In fact, it is, I think, politically quite adamant that it sticks with the current policy and practice. And so this case is again back at the Court of Justice. This has a serious rule of law implication too. It's not only that we can expect perhaps Hungary to be fined, but also that this has consequences when it comes to Hungary's access to EU funds, and the non-implementation, the complete disregard for Court of Justice judgments has also meant that Hungary doesn't have access to albeit limited amount of EU funding. So when we compare this to the Strasbourg quite elaborate system of supervising the execution of judgments, of course, I think we have a stronger system under EU law.
Yeah, thank you. So the main advantage of litigating strategically with EU law would be the impact, essentially, if I understand correctly.
Yes, that is true. But if I can add one thing, we also see strategic litigation is one tool to achieve change, systemic change, and another tool is advocacy. And the two go really hand in hand. So when it comes to implementation of an execution of judgments, for example, it's really very obvious from our work that we do both advocacy vis-a-vis the Committee of Ministers or advocacy vis-a-vis even the national authorities when it comes to, for example, the execution of judgments. And this is something that I think many organizations are, and lawyers are now quite cognizant of. You cannot separate advocacy from strategic litigation. They support each other. They reinforce each other. When we look at, for example, the poor record of Hungary in implementing judgments of the European Court of Human Rights, we also are thinking about ways to reinforce this systemic approach at the Hungarian national level. Together with the European Implementation Network, there's a lot of very innovative and well thought through ideas about how at the national level systems could be created to ensure that the implementation of judgments is supervised, that it happens fast, that it's done in a coordinated manner at the national level.
Thank you. I actually, my next question was already going a bit in this direction. And so my next question is linked also to the focus of our special issue, which is like, who does strategic litigation in EU law empower or disempower? And the question comes at least partly from the thinking that litigation is often perceived as an elite strategy, partly because of expertise, partly because of resources. And one of the questions that we also pose with the special issue is really what are these power shifts that strategic litigation in EU law triggers? And one question that I have for you is, how, as an NGO, do you ensure that the disempowered communities are empowered or benefit from strategic litigation?
Perhaps one approach is to look at access. The question of access to legal assistance and access to expert legal assistance. So it is certainly true that strategic litigation on fundamental rights issues is not something that every legal professional in a country does, and it requires the manifold resources we have discussed about time, expertise, patience, contacts, networks. But I think it's quite important to support every legal professional to understand how certain tools under European Union law particularly can help advance their legal practice and support their clients. So broadening this access to a broader group of legal professionals will, I think, inherently mean that more citizens have the indirectly access to this kind of support. A few years ago, I think it was in 2018 and 19, that a group of experts were hired by the European Commission to look into how strategic litigation on fundamental rights could be supported by the European Union. And they produced a very extensive and still very valid feasibility study where they looked at a variety of questions on strategic litigation. And one of their recommendations was really in the field of training and building up this expertise. And so while some of their recommendations about providing direct funding or indirect funding to litigation, to actual cases, hasn't been realized, but over the past few years, we've seen how the European Commission, with the Citizens Equality Rights and Values Program, has started supporting the capacity building, as it said, the training of legal professionals in the Fundamental Rights Charter and more broadly on how to use European Union law. We ourselves are involved in two large projects that are funded by the EU Commission's CERF program. One of them, Starlight, is actually pan-European. So we together with the Hertie School in Berlin, train lawyers NGO lawyers and also individual legal practitioners to understand and start using EU law, but also there are certain more at need countries like Hungary, and this is where the other project is focused on, to get more a broader constituency to understand what the EU law offers. And so we have, for example, in Hungary, been able to work with legal professionals affiliated with trade unions. And this has opened up a space of dialogue and also of learning that brings EU law and the protections it offers, I think, much closer to a wider group in the Hungarian population.
So we have seen, like in the past decade at least, a quite consistent growth in strategic litigation being brought to the Court of Justice across various fields. And in light of these efforts to essentially build capacity in civil society to mobilize EU law for fundamental rights protection, how do you see the future of strategic litigation in EU law? Do you think this growth will continue? Which trajectories of evolution can you envisage?
So the future of strategic litigation in EU law hopefully will be a happy one. And there's a lot of opportunities, but there is pressures and challenges. And I think we have to be quite cognizant of both. When it comes to opportunities, the Charter of Fundamental Rights and the related trainings that are ongoing and will be rolled out in the years to come, I think are really key, so that it really comes alive as an instrument that lawyers, judges, all sorts of legal professionals start using it in not only very high profile cases, but in everyday practice. So I think on the charter, we can expect a lot more to happen in the next years because of these investments made into training. Also, something that we're quite keen to see, and I think this is at the moment perhaps more of an academic interest, but it is quite likely to be translated into all actual litigation, is Article 2 of the treaty. Article 2 is, of course, often referred to as a set of core EU values, but the question of whether these values can be enforced in court is really coming to the fore. Certain highly visible or well-reported cases from Poland and Hungary are already exposing this. Just at the moment, for example, we have a new law in Hungary that is, I'd say, a very serious step in the backsliding on civil society and freedom of the media in general and political participation. The law I'm thinking of is called the Law to Protect National Sovereignty, which sets up a pretty intrusive office that can carry out investigations without any legal remedies afforded to those that come under investigation. This is a new step in the shrinking civic space and shrinking media space domain. And so when the European Commission launched an infringement process, from the press release, it seemed that Article 2 values are also going to be part of this legal action that the Commission will pursue. We're very keen to see this flesh out in the Commission's claim in its submission to the court and how the court will approach this. But certainly notions about democracy, about the right of European citizens to participate in European elections and in a free, unhindered manner are coming under scrutiny in this case. And I think more broadly, the idea of democracy as one of these core EU values will be tested. So with more academic interest, these kind of real life scenarios that are going to unfold in the future will have the support of good legal arguments. And I think in this domain, on Article 2, we're for sure going to see more cases. But then there's the challenges I mentioned. So the challenges, of course, relate partly to whether there's an ecosystem that can support this kind of litigation, the ecosystem of supportive donors that understand that litigation is a very important tool to reinforce rights, but that it takes time. We need trained legal professionals, lawyers, judges. We need organizations that see this as a part of a broader strategy. We need also, I think, cross-sectoral networks of academics and NGOs and lawyers to work on these. And there's good practices already out there, for example, in the good lobby profs. But lastly, we also have to see how this kind of strategic litigation to advance fundamental rights is also complemented or perhaps negated by strategic litigation that is meant to undermine fundamental rights. And this undermining of fundamental rights is very visible, for example, in the reproductive rights arena. Also, when it comes to the rights of minorities. And sadly, the litigation ongoing is very often quite strategic, very well coordinated, very well funded. And this is, in a way, going in the other direction, in the exactly opposite direction. And a lot of the attention that we focus on when we talk about strategic litigation talks about how this advances rights. But in reality, there's a lot of groups that are very keen on reversing rights.
Yeah, thank you. This is actually one of the things that we try to advance also with our special issue, which is precisely this fact that, two things, kind of. One, that strategic litigations happens in the court, but also does happen very much around the court, so that it's not just about the litigation per se, but it's really about indeed networks, coalition building, selecting the right applicant, follow-up, advocacy, convergence of strategies, but also precisely the fact that you're mentioning, and it's interesting that now you're bringing the conservative litigation on reproductive rights, for example, because indeed strategic litigation is often understood as pursuing or associated at least with the pursuing of progressive agendas. But indeed, there is also a bit the other side. So strategies and legal strategies can also be pursued by actors that try to push indeed conservative agendas. I would have a lot of other questions, but I think time is running out. So I would really want to warmly thank you for joining us today and for sharing all these insights from your practices of strategic litigation and as members of a human rights NGO. I think many of these points resonate also with our reflections in the special issue on strategic litigation in EU law. And this will be available open access on the German Law Journal. So hopefully this can be the start of a conversation. Many thanks for listening and goodbye.